Hey, good morning, Sam. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning to you.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. All right.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful snowstorm. We're back this Thursday. Of course, you're doing the environment show, Sam.
Yeah, I got a couple environment items coming up. And then you've got an interview lined up today. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I'm really excited because Elliot Adams has come down to our station. He is from Veterans for Peace, and Nancy Smith will be joining him. Nancy Smith, who was arrested earlier this year in Georgia for a protest at the School of the Americas. We'll be talking about that at 10:15, interviewing them. So stay tuned, guys.
Okay, let's see. I just have a few environmental updates this week. Am I on? Yeah. Let's see. Really well-deserved news in the Albany Times-Union last Friday, December 24th, in a story by Stephanie Lee called Two Elises Tackle One Big Environmental Issue. Elise Kuntz and Elise Griffin, co-founders of CASE, the Community Advocates for Safe Emissions, were named among 10 regional residents in the Times Union's 2010 Top Newsmakers and Extraordinary People. Griffin and Kuntz are both lifelong locals and formed CASE 2 years ago to urge the state to crack down on the emissions produced by the Lafarge cement factory. Lafarge has operated since 1962 and is reported to be New York's second largest source of airborne mercury, a potent neurotoxin. The story goes on to say that neither Elise has a background in environmental issues. Griffin, 30, grew concerned when her then 4-year-old son was acting unusually aggressive. Tests revealed elevated levels of mercury and lead in his body. Though she can't be certain what caused those high levels, she has since moved her family to Albany, and her son is now functioning like all the other kids in his class. Kuntz, 46, recalls a childhood in Queens punctuated by asthma and sinus infections. The goal of CASE is not to shut down the Lafarge plant, but to make it cleaner, more advanced, and more transparent. Says Kuntz, "It's definitely been a learning curve for us to learn not only about the health issues, but to also try to understand the whole practice of making cement and how that can be done safely. We're going to live with the consequences of it for pretty much the rest of our lives." CASE is partnering with other groups to hire scientific experts to evaluate Lafarge's modernization proposal. So this is a pivotal time and a pivotal coming year for all the work they're doing, and they need your support. You can go to case-newyork.org. That's CASE-NY.org. Or you can write to them at P.O. Box 291, Ravenna, New York, 12143. Interestingly, after that article in this past Monday's Daily Mail, a new story appeared about how Lafarge is reclaiming its old quarries for eventual use as a public park. Once the land is mined to capacity, Lafarge's environmental manager, John Regan, said it will be covered with topsoil and planted with various indigenous plants to make a public park. So, that's at least some good news there. And you can read more about that story on the Newsroom blog at WGXC.org. And some other good environmental news. Yesterday, four Columbia County property owners have permanently protected 185 acres of their properties, according to the CLC, Columbia Land Conservancy. The properties, owned by two couples, include protected wetlands and working farms. Joe and Diane Haley protected 110 acres in Ghent and Claverack. In Ancrum, William and Deborah Cohen protected their 75-acre property. William Cohen says, "My wife and I decided to put our land into a conservation easement because we wanted to preserve its astonishing natural beauty forever. Its essential purpose is farmland and provides a means to enjoy the simpler things in life." The property owners donated the development rights of their property to CLC, and this ensures that the property is permanently conserved. The property owners retain title to their property, pay property taxes, and can sell or pass the property to heirs. They can still farm on the land and are not required to allow public access. CLC now holds 150 easements that protects 21,135 acres. You can read more about this story at WGXC.org in the newsroom. In fracking news this week, the Delaware Riverkeeper is calling on their site for urgent help needed. Apparently, the DRBC, Delaware River Basin Commission, has prematurely issued draft natural gas development regulations for the Delaware River watershed. A cumulative impact analysis of natural gas drilling effects on the Delaware River Basin's water resources is in the final stages of federal funding approval, and that study was to have been completed before these gas rules were drafted by the DRBC. So, apparently, despite a storm of protest and requests from thousands of citizens and 77 organizations, including Governor Patterson, Congressman Maurice Hinchey, Congressman Rush Holt from New Jersey, New York City Mayor Bloomberg, and the Philadelphia City Council, for the DRBC to wait for the science before issuing their draft gas rules, the science first plea has fallen on deaf ears at the DRBC. The DRBC has set only 90 days now for public comment. Given the fact this issue affects tens of thousands of people in New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, there should be at least 6 months for review and public comment. It's a complicated issue, but one thing is very clear: the public participation process is sorely lacking. As Delaware Riverkeeper says on their site, "We cannot sacrifice our water for gas." You can go to the Delaware Riverkeeper website, DelawareRiverkeeper.org, or call 1-800-8-DELAWARE to find out more about this and for a sample letter that you can sign and send. So, the frackers are really forging ahead quickly. I'm just going to play one song here before we get to the interviews we have today with Christina here on Tell It Like It Is. I know.
just land, you're in the wrong hands. Stretched every way like a rubber band. I'm calling out to all Earth fans. Come on. children. But the violence had been chosen. We can't stop. His people
Thank you. That was Jesse Colin Young with Peace Song, written probably over 40 years ago, and it's still quite appropriate today, unfortunately. This is Christina with Tell It Like It Is, Sam Engineering, and Richard and Alan with me. And our guest, Nancy Smith, activist and teacher and many other things that she does. I'll let her introduce herself. And Elliot Adams from Veterans for Peace, who came all the way from Schoharie County this morning to be with us. Thank you, Elliot, for making the trip.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Fantastic.
Thanks so much.
And Nancy, I'm just going to see if your mic is working. I'm just going to have you say hello. And
it's wonderful to be here at this wonderful radio station. I was very pleased to be invited. Thanks, Christina.
Oh, my pleasure. And that your voice is coming through loud and clear. Great. So I just wanted to start very quickly with Elliot maybe telling us a little bit about the background of the School of the Americas, which I understand has now changed its name. And the reason why we're talking about this today is just because there was a recent protest of many people from Columbia County. I don't know if anyone from Greene County was there. Certainly Elliot was there from Schoharie, but who went down to Georgia to protest this institution. And I wanted to know if you could tell us a little bit of its background.
Sure. Many of us are really upset by our government's involvement in the brutality and torture that's happening in Central America. Key to that process has been this thing which was originally called School of America and has now been changed to WINSEC. But it is a school by which our U.S. military trains officers of the military in Central and South America, and which on its face sounds fine. Yet when we look at the record, a high percentage of them have been involved in murders, rapes, torture, disappearing. And we feel that and then when we look at some of the records, we even discover that some of that is actually the training that occurred at School of Americas. As a result of that, many of us, like 10, 15,000 strong, go down each year to Fort Benning to try to stop our government being involved in this kind of horrific, immoral actions. So we've asked at Fort Benning to try to do that. There has been some success in that they closed the School of Americas and reopened WINSEC all at the same time. So it was a technical aspect. But part of that process has been people who have felt so committed that they put their life on their body on the line and violate the laws of school Fort Benning to try to draw attention to this issue.
Okay. Well, we're going to get to that because that's an issue that I'd like to touch on with Nancy, who actually was recently arrested. But before we even get there, there's a number of things that you just said which are really amazing, maybe to some people, maybe not to others who have been listening to WikiLeaks or have an idea of the history of CIA and involvement in other countries. But you're saying that the School of the Americas actually trains soldiers, and those soldiers go into countries primarily in Latin America and South America and then train there?
It trains native officers there, yes.
And what is the purpose of that, Nancy? Do you...
Well, actually, excuse me, I think the important thing to remember about the School of Americas is that the Army does not do that on its own. Mm. This is part of the Department of State policy toward other countries. And our first reaction is to make that assistance and that aid military aid. And so much of our money goes into that. And this is just a little part of what happens, is this training school that's been there for decades. And I believe it first started in Panama. It was first operating in Panama and then moved into territorial United States at Fort Benning. But the issue here is that this is our initial response to sending aid to foreign countries. And people in charge of countries want their military to be strong and want their police force to be strong. And so it's a very easily accessible way of sending aid overseas. And when we began to look at what was happening in Latin American countries, in Central America and in South America, what you begin to see is that the military are involved in horrendous suppression of people's basic rights to form civil organizations such as unions, agricultural cooperatives, universities, which teach another way of looking at governance, to teach lawyers who are upholding people's rights and the difficulty that they have in doing that. And so it turns out that kind of training really is in support of repressive dictatorships over and over again. Remember Bishop Romero?
Yes.
In the 1980s, that assassination. And members of his family also have been assassinated. And names of the people who were responsible for that were directly connected to graduates of the School of the Americas. And there was in the 80s, I think in the late 80s, there was an investigative report done by the New York Times in which they connected names of graduates to those who had actually conducted those assassinations. They began to look at the materials that were used in training soldiers and their officers at the School of Americas, and they were training them in assassination techniques, counterinsurgency techniques. They were training them in torture, how to elicit confessions from these people. And you have to ask yourself, what are we doing? What kind of business are we in there? Father Roy Bourgeois, a Mary Knoll priest, was the first who brought this very dramatically to the attention of the American public and those who were interested in Latin and Central American policy very dramatically. And he is still involved with these issues. So he started this demonstration at the front gate of Fort Benning. and it has grown dramatically. It's one of the largest continuing, ongoing demonstrations and in the United States today. Every year, in the third week of November, the third weekend of November, it takes place, and we get thousands and thousands of people from all over the country.
How many years has this been going on?
It's about 20 years now. And the numbers started out very small. In the 70s and early 80s, it grew to thousands and thousands of people. This past year, there were 5,000 people from as far away as Iowa and California who come regularly to this, and new ones, and a lot of young people, mm-hmm. a lot of college students and even high school students come, and they come repeatedly year after year. It's on their schedule. So it has the people who come to the SOA demonstration in November come from all over the country, all ages, all walks of life.
Because there are a lot of young people also listening to this program, we may know who Bishop Romero is, but can we go back just for a moment and discuss who and what happened?
Bishop Romero is a Catholic bishop in Central America, in El Salvador, and a beloved bishop in a country that was primarily Catholic. He reached out to the poor in that country, made Catholicism responsive to the poverty in these countries, particularly agricultural workers and others who were without protection from the law, were exploited in their work, and had no assistance from the government. And he was a thorn in the side of the state government, and was always spoke out for poor people. And his assassination, I believe it was 1989, was just shocking. He was killed while he was at the altar conducting Mass. Mm. And the men who did that were trained at School of Americas, right, in the United States. They were trained in those kinds of techniques. And since that time, members of his family have continued to be assassinated. And he is probably the most prominent person. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, there are one of the other things that's marked very tenderly at the SOA demonstration is the assassination of an entire village in Guatemala, mm-hmm. El Mozotle, where a brigade of soldiers from the government were sent to simply wipe out this community, who were thought to provide shelter for insurgents who were fighting for better rights in Guatemala. And they killed over 700 people, men, women, babies, little children. Mm-hmm. The world heard about it because one person survived by hiding for a week in the bush. She heard her own children being assassinated. This is recent history, and we're responsible for that. Our tax dollars pay for that. And no one has been brought to justice for those actions.
I want to ask, in the context of the bigger picture, because there's still those of us who have this dissonance in our heads that we're, you know, this country, we're the people who are fighting the terrorists. We're the people who are exporting democracy to other countries. We are currently involved with a war on two borders, and we are making excursions into another sovereign country, Pakistan. We are using drone missile attacks. Alan Nairn was on, who's a reporter who's living abroad now, award-winning investigative reporter, who was on Democracy Now! Yesterday, mm-hmm. and basically talked about the U.S. as a military power, and in fact, the economy of the U.S. is gone beyond the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about, but is in fact that is all that we have right now. So does that, in saying that, it makes sense that we are exporting weapons, we are exporting war as the base of our economy. And I'm wondering if you, Elliot, from Veterans for Peace, can talk about the history of Veterans for Peace and their formation as a response to people in this country protesting this country's role as a military power.
Sure. That is very much what we are. We are veterans who have gone to war. I mean, I volunteered for the Army. I volunteered to be a paratrooper. I volunteered for Vietnam. I believe at that point that somehow war was what guaranteed peace and all those myths. And that's mm-hmm. what we are as people who have been there and come back and said, now, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And usually in the process of doing that, we have also said, wait a minute, there's something about our foreign policy we don't understand. What are we doing in these foreign countries? And we often refer back to General Smedley Butler, who was who served during World War I and up to almost World War II, who after he was a two-star general, I believe he was the only American soldier who ever won the Congressional Medal of Honor twice. And when he retired, he said, you know, I was a prostitute for the corporations. I was guaranteeing their rights in all these foreign countries. Mm. And we all see that now. That's what we were doing in Vietnam. That's what we're doing in Iraq. That's what we're doing in Afghanistan. That's what we're doing in Colombia. Colombia, we have a huge military presence there now. So this is our foreign policy. Our foreign policy is the U.S. military guaranteeing natural resources for our corporations. And incidentally, I want to point out it's not for us. It's for our corporations. So, for example, you take the oil in Iraq. Well, we fought a war in Iraq at about $1 trillion so that our corporations could buy that oil cheaply, and they sell it to us at exactly the market price that they would have sold it to us otherwise. So we've invested. In fact, Parente was talking about the issue of bananas in Panama, and he was talking to somebody and saying, well, you know, the U.S. corporations are down there guaranteeing that those bananas come to come to the United States, et cetera, to the U.S. corporations. And the person said, well, I looked at it more carefully, and I realized that can't be true, because we spent $24 million in that battle, and there were only $12.5 million worth of bananas there. And as Parente said, yes, but the American people paid the $24 million, and the corporations got the $12.5 million, so of course they wanted it. Mm-hmm. So it is very much a part of our foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got away from a little bit from Veterans for Peace. So that's who we are. Excuse me. People who have served already and now see a higher responsibility to work for world peace. We have about 7,000 strong. We have chapters in virtually every state in the union.
So it's a national organization.
Very much so. Okay. Very much so. Very committed, very dedicated, because there's that old saying amongst veterans that new wars scratch open the old wounds and old vets. So we come to it very committed.
Did you want to say something, Alan?
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question. I wanted to ask about Blackwater and these kind of privatized and military industrial complex organizations. Are they involved in these kind of activities? And number two, what is the appeal to young men and women who get involved in this kind of training to be murderers in other countries?
That's a strong word.
I think you've touched on a lot of things. One is the whole modern process of privatization of our military. But we see that throughout our whole government. We're privatizing everything. We're privatizing all kinds of things that don't work that way because somebody can make money. And it's a fundamental thing. We believe in, you know, the reason we form a government is for common needs, to serve common purposes, and we form things like fire departments, police departments, armies, highway departments to serve those common needs. When you privatize them, you private corporations work to make profits. They don't work to serve the common needs. And in fact, we saw that at Heathrow Airport in this recent deal. Turns out that they turned it over to a private corporation, and they were concentrating on how do we maximize our dollars, how do we make more stores and things like that in the rather than how do we take care of getting airplanes in and out safely. But going back to this question, you put your finger on a very, very poignant thing, which is why do soldiers, young people, join to become murderers? And the poignant, almost horrifying thing is that most soldiers join out of wanting to do good for the most. Out of dedication, out of ilimazner, out of altruism to other people, willing to sacrifice themselves to help others. And then they get subverted into this situation where they aren't. I mean, the reality is wars are not about solving problems. They don't solve problems, and we know how to solve conflict. Wars are not about national security. They don't create national security, and we know how to. But soldiers join trying to do that, and then find themselves subtly being sucked into a very different role, and it's so hard to see the bigger picture that it takes many of us have to wait until after we get out to really see the truth.
All over the world, soldiers are drawn from poor people's families. And that happens over and over and over again. It's a way to get out of the arduous work of trying to earn a living on barren ground. And once you get in, as Elliot says, once you get involved in that system, you become part of it without hardly even noticing it. And if there's a lot of fanfare about it and marching bands and the president of the country says, "Aren't you wonderful?" and everybody is proud of you, then a little assassination here and there is hardly noticed. But these are poor folks who become soldiers in this country. Look at who gets recruited for our wars. Right.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens in other countries. These are poor boys who have no place to go in their society.
I think the demographics for the most people who were recruited into the military in the last 10 years have come from were white and rural, low income people. And as a friend of mine who is a Vietnam era veteran used to say, there's no accident that they're recruiting them at 16, 17, and 18 because you're not quite a fully grown person at that age. And I think it's easy to manipulate people. But once you get into your 20s, and I think this is the problem with a lot of vets coming back, once they've seen 2 to 4 years worth of action, and now it's horrifying that it's repeated, mandatorily repeated incursions or periods that have to be served, that people start going crazy because they start having a moral conscience. I mean, going crazy is really an appropriate way of saying it, but having suffering from PTSD, and you would know more about this, Elliot, than I.
Well, I want to say something here which I think is important. I never like to let anybody off the hook. The reality is that a lot of the reason why, for example, I joined the military was every park has a monument to some war event. Our history books falsely create a picture of constant war, and as part of it, our society glorifies soldiers, and all these things play an extremely important role in why people join the military. I know it played a role in why I did, not because I joined. How else could I have believed that I was saving my mother and sister from the Viet Cong 10,000 miles across the ocean with an effective firing range of maybe 5,000 feet? It was the miss. I remember after I spent many years, 30 years as a closet vet, trying to deal with my issue. And I remember after I came out, I was at a Memorial Day parade, and there was a little kid sitting on a curb with shorts on. It was classic Norman Rockwell, waving a little American flag absent mildly. The sun was coming across the street, hitting him. And I broke out in tears because I realized that was the beginning of the making of a soldier.
Right.
Why is our Memorial Day parade a every band that can roll down the street and play music? Why shouldn't it be people in black and in a dirge? Aren't we saying, wait a minute, what have we done? Have these people? Did we ask these people to give their lives for a meaningful reason? And even what we now call Vet Day, which used to be Armistice Day. You know, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the final ending of the war to end all wars. And it was designed, it was originally created as a holiday in which schools and people and churches in the nation were encouraged to do things to create connectedness between different people and get around some of the things that cause war, because originally what was called Armistice Day was about trying to avoid further wars.
Right. Go ahead, Bridger.
Don't you think that we kind of purport fascism as nationalism, and that these events are symbolic of the experience that's being imposed and maintained on our society, that in a very, unconscious way feed this nationalism, position. But as children grow into this whole experience, become more and more fascist as they get older and older. And it's like our country's biggest secret. For example, that our president is not really a president of anything. He's a CEO of a management company that works for the corporations. What do you think of that?
I think absolutely. And war is a powerful tool for, I often say that the biggest victim of any war is the nation being attacked. The second biggest victim of any war is the people of the nation attacking, because war is always used as a massive process for extracting money from the people. So, for example, I was thinking about the occupation of Iraq, and I was thinking, oh my God, this thing's costing us $320 million a day. And I thought, well, wait a minute, there's another way of looking at this, which is that every single day we're in Iraq, $720 million gets squozed out of the blood, sweat, and tears of the American working man and woman and put in the pocket of the filthy rich. Mm. Now, where I come from up in Schoharie County, we call $720 million a day motivation.
Mm.
You want to know why we have wars? That's why we have wars. Because there is so much, and the price we pay as a nation, as you brought up earlier, Alan, is huge, because we pay for it. We pay for it not only, just take this, not only do we pay for it in the sense of we give our children, we pay for it in the sense that we're giving the money of our generation, next generation, and our children's generation at this point. We also, if you watch Under the Dark Cloud of War, is a time when most of our rights are taken back from us. So we lose our rights, and it's all tied up with this nationalism and flag waving and people stopping, failing to say, wait a minute, I need to apply my morals to this. There isn't somebody who's got a better answer. I have to make those decisions myself.
I'd like to ask Nancy, because we've been talking about the evils of war. I think we're all on the same page with that. I think we've touched on the mechanisms and why we go to war. But when you brought up just now waking up of moral issues, I want to specifically ask Nancy about this, because she decided to cross a line. Someone right now that I feel needs to be really supported is Private First Class Bradley Manning. He crossed the line. Who is right now worse than Julian Assange, is still in jail without any communication with the outside world. And he is, for people who don't know, is the officer who is allegedly the person who leaked all the memos to WikiLeaks. And the story I've heard, and maybe you guys know something differently, is that he did that because he was protesting the fact that none of his superior officers were listening to the fact that the military was involved with kidnapping people who were innocent. as it turned out, and torturing them. I mean, this last war, more than any war, has really opened up the doors to torture. I mean, it's wide open, from Cheney to Rumsfeld, Bush in the last. We still haven't closed down Guantanamo. What gives people what is the moral force, Nancy? How does it come into being for a person to just say, no, that's enough. I'm going to blow the whistle. I'm going to cross the line.
I think that those kinds of ideas grow slowly through our childhood and our adulthood. Not everyone can cross the line, even though they might believe it ferociously. It's just not possible. And I'm at a time in my life where I have no responsibilities at home. I don't have a job. And I can afford to do that in terms of time and also money. One of the things that happens when you're in prison is that they cut off your Social Security.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. So you have to be able to afford that. And I feel very lucky to be able to make this kind of witness at this point in my life. And it seems like writing letters and waving flags and marching here and marching there and holding signs is all a part of it. But this seems to me to be a stronger message, a more targeted way of looking at the vast complex that gives the United States this sense that we can go into any country with weapons and money and force it to be different from what it is. So I feel truly blessed to be able to do that. And I've had a wonderful amount of support. People have been hugely responsive to what I'm doing, and I'm just inundated with goodwill from so many people in Columbia County. I live in Claverick, and people that I haven't talked to for years are saying, I think it's wonderful. And it's been quite an experience so far.
Nancy, could you tell us what you are expecting to have happen?
Well, I was crossing the line, for those of you who might not know, means that the legitimate and permitted area for the demonstration is just outside the main gate of Fort Benning, and it's all cordoned off with not only tape but chain link fence and razor wire, so that you know very clearly where the line is onto Fort Benning property. And the phrase "crossing the line" means that you find a way to get across that line. It's Fort Benning is a huge complex. That fence around there must be 20 miles in perimeter. So there, in the past, people have dug holes underneath the fence or climbed over the fence. But this year, four of us crossed the line, and I crossed with Father Louis Vitali, who is a well-known activist, a Franciscan priest, who was crossing for the fourth time. And what we did was we went around to a small highway which led to another gate of Fort Benning, and we walked quickly down this ramp, which was sort of four lanes of traffic in width. We walked quickly down this ramp about a mile, and by that time we had gone past all of the warning signs, which say, we're waiting for a train to cross through Hudson. That's wonderful.
Middle. That's right.
Not every.
You can't force the river, and you can't force the train.
Anyway, we walked down towards the gate, past signs which said, in effect, you are now trespassing on U.S. military property. Unless you have legitimate business here, you will be arrested. And you know, very soon after that, several cars with flashing blue lights converged on us, and questioned us, patted us down for objects which might be, quote, harmful to ourselves or to others, and put us in handcuffs behind our backs mm-hmm. and into separate cars, separating us, and took us for into the interior of Fort Benning. The men who arrested us, and women, because there was a woman there, who arrested us are not military. They are part of the police of the Department of Defense.
Oh.
So we were taken to a police station inside the gates of Fort Benning, where we were had mugshots and fingerprints, and then people from School of the Americas Watch, which is the umbrella organization that plans this demonstration every year, have lawyers that give support to people who cross the line. So they arrived with bail and arranged for us to be bailed out. A couple days later, we went to court for an arraignment where the charges against us were read, and we were told to report for court for trial. So I'll be going back down to Georgia, to Columbus, Georgia, to the federal court, because crossing on military property is a federal offense. It's a federal misdemeanor, the lightest of punishments would accrue to misdemeanors. Anyway, I'll be back down in court on the 5th of January, and at that time the trial will take place and I will be sentenced. So we're expecting, from the experience of people who watch this court, this district court, over a number of years, that we will also get 6 months, which is the maximum sentence. In the past, the judge who presided over this court for the past 20 years was giving lighter sentences and behaved in a different way. But two of the four of us have already been sentenced to 6 months, 6 months. And so that's what I'm expecting, and my co-defendant.
Unbelievable. You know, I can't believe that we're down to the last 7 minutes. And so what I want to get to are two things. This is what people can do to support the effort to shut down WNSAC or School of the Americas, what they can do to support you, because I can't believe that you're facing 6 months in jail. And I also wanted to save enough time for Elliot Adams to tell us a little bit about the December 16th action. So, Nancy, maybe you can tell us a little bit about places to contact.
Sure. The thing to do is to go to is to look on your computer and get more information. Mm-hmm. Always get more information. School of the Americas Watch has a wonderful insight, a wonderful website with lots of connections to information, historic information, information about Father Roy Bourgeois, who was the founder of this organization. They have an office in Washington which follows legislation that which has introduced legislation and follows that legislation on its way through Congress. So they for sure should be in touch with that. Supporting SOA Watch financially is something that you can do with just by getting their address and helping in that way, and also talking to your representatives in the federal government about what you've learned about this institution.
Okay, and Elliot,
I just want to just piggyback a little bit of what Nancy said. We all have things we don't like and we think need to be changed, but frequently we don't act on them. And Nancy is an illustration of somebody who is willing to throw her body in the gears of the machine. Maybe not the most effective. It's not going to stop it all by herself. But the point is that she's willing to put her whole life at risk for this action. And we need to at least support her and recognize how important she is convinced about how important she feels about this issue, that she's willing to commit that, which makes it a very important issue. So we need to acknowledge that.
That's wonderful to hear, and I thank you so much for that. But at the same time, we have to recognize I'm white and I'm educated, and they're not going to mess with me. That's what I believe.
So far.
And so far. I've been treated very politely. Nobody has been harsh or hard with me. And I think that's going to continue. That's just where I come from in this society. Mm-hmm. And that's through no credit to me. That's just how I was born. Contrast that with the private penal institutions, which house thousands and thousands of undocumented workers in this country. We did a vigil outside of Columbus. There is an ICE facility, Immigration and Customs Institution, where there are 2,000, mostly men, in prison. They're waiting deportation. They have no access to lawyers. They have no community behind them. They have been taken away from their families. Some of them are U.S. citizens who will be sent back to Mexico, probably, because it's the shortest distance, just taken over the border and dumped. It doesn't have adequate oversight. It's outside of the justice system of this country. Those are the people that need our aid.
So Ned,
that's one question. Have either of you ever had discussions of your experiences with local politicians? What's been their response?
No, I have not. This just happened a few weeks ago for me. So with my local politicians, I have not had those discussions, but perhaps Elliot has.
Well, I have some. I also have like over 15 years in local elected public office, so I have a view towards the political process. And in fact, I left the political process to go to the streets because I realized that change does not occur from politicians, from our government, from our Congress. Mm-hmm. Congress and the Senate was set up not to create change but to maintain the status quo. And I believe that real change, I mean, if you're trying to make a minor adjustment to the system, a little increase in the benefits for something or other, or some minor adjustment to the system, then lobbying Congress makes sense. But what we're talking about is fundamental change here. I believe we should end war, for example. That's a big change. And that will not happen through Congress. That will happen through changing the feelings of the American people, one by one, 10 by 10, who knows what. But
Yeah, changing our overall consciousness is really what needs to happen.
And that we do, that I think we do in the streets.
I was just going to ask, do you get a sense that they are aware that they participate in a charade? Do you get
politicians?
That? Yes.
I don't think so, really. I think that we all rationalize what we're doing. I know when I suddenly recognized that the change did not come from the political process, from the political process, I withdrew from it. I enjoyed being a politician. I enjoyed making the government work for people. But when I suddenly realized that it wasn't the place to create the change, I left it.
I just have a quote from Alan Nairns yesterday's the talk on Democracy Now. Alan Nairns says, "You vote for Democrat, you vote for Republican, you get the same thing on state murder, on preventable death. But we here have the right to rebel. We have to use it." So I would like to ask both of you to come back, hopefully not in a much further a future date for Nancy, but to actually maybe talk concretely about what form does that rebellion take? Because I think many folks on the left or people who are finding out about what this government is about and its connection to corporations and that we're not quite living in the democracy that we think we are living in. How does that form the rebellion and how do we change things? So I want to thank you both, but I want to go back to Elliot very quickly. We have just another couple of minutes. We can go a little bit over time. And just to tell us about the December 16th action and about how we can contact if somebody wants to get involved with Veterans for Peace.
Sure. So on December 16th, we, Veterans for Peace, having written Obama asking him to meet with us to talk about the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan and half of the rest of, and maybe Iran and anyway, and he did not meet with us. So we felt we had little choice. So we went down to Washington. We wound up locking ourselves to the fence in front of the White House, calling for him to come to talk to us, to talk about his issue, to try to bring light to it. We had about 500 people came. 130 of us were arrested mm-hmm. there. I want to note that it's a very different kind of arrest than Nancy's willing to take. The risks for us are tiny by comparison. But it is part of this process of trying to say citizenship requires more than voting. Mm-hmm. It requires creating the change that needs to be changed. And the governmental system, we created it to serve the common good, but we have to understand we also created it to maintain itself, so it's not good at making adjustment. In my more cynical days, I say the political process is a process that's designed to soak up the creative change, the creative energy for change harmlessly.
You remember what Howard Zinn says, that civil disobedience is not the problem. The problem is civil obedience. And I keep trying to remember that. I think that's a wonderful statement of summary of what Elliot has just been saying.
I want to thank you both.
So I also yes. would like to say you can always visit our website at veteransforpeace.org. Obviously, money is always a concern for us. So are any veterans who can join our statement of purpose and haven't joined us, we'd love to have you take a look at our website and join us.
Okay. Thank you both very much for coming in, and we'll see.
Thank you, Christina.
Thank you. We'll see you folks next week at 10 o'clock for another edition of Tell It Like It Is. I want to thank Sam for engineering, and we're going out with a little Leonard Cohen, The Land of Plenty.
Have the courage to stand where I must stand. Don't really have the temperament to lend a helping hand. Don't really know who sent me to raise my voice and say, may the lights in the land of plenty shine on the truth some day. I don't know why I've come here, knowing as I do what you really think of me, what I really think of you. For the millions in a prison that wealth has set apart, for the Christ who has not risen from the caverns of the heart, for the innermost decision that we cannot but obey, for what's left of our religion, I lift my voice and pray. May the lights in the land of plenty, may the lights in the land of plenty, may the lights in the land of plenty shine on the truth someday. I know I said I need you, I meet you at the store, but I can't buy it, baby, I can't buy it anymore. I don't really know who sent me to raise my voice and say, may the light in the land of plenty shine on the truth someday. For the innermost decision that we cannot but obey, for what's left of our religion, I lift my voice. and pray. May the light in the land of plenty may the light in the land of plenty shine on the truth someday.
You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Catskill, Hudson, Chatham.